Madrid on ADS, Young Mills, and the Easing Model.
Okay, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Okay, I put the title ADS, probably ADS, Young Mills, and the Easing Model. Okay, essentially, I am not talking, I'm not going to talk about ADS part. I am only going to be concentrated on what is the integrability of the what we can call the Young-Mills spin chain correspondence, and a particular relation to the two-dimensional Easing Model. This is a small comment, but I find it curious and interesting. This is a work I am doing, okay, will appear in 1 or 2 days in the archives. I am doing with my student Johan Gunnarsson, that is a first year student, and Rafael Hernandez, that now is postdoc in the Institute of Madrid. Okay, let me just start making a short, short review of this Young-Mills spin chain correspondent, just simply to fix a little bit the notation, because everybody here knows very well what is the content of this. Now, this Young-Mills spin chain correspondence essentially is inspired, or appears a little bit inspired by the work of BMN. And essentially, the idea is the following. The idea is for working in N equal 4 supersymmetric Young-Mills in the Larsen limit, where we can just consider single trace operators or concentrate ourselves on single trace operators and avoid some heavy problems of mixing, then you can try to define and to work out the dilatation operator from the standard normalization group approach that is defined as the operator that is giving us the scaling dimension of the operator O. Now, the beautiful approach of relating this problem, which is an eigenvalue problem for single trace operators in the Larsen limit for this highly supersymmetric gauge theory, but anyway, this very interesting normalization group problem into some problem in two-dimensional physics with integrability, I believe is a very interesting progress in the recent understanding of the dynamics of gauge theory. Now, the Young-Mills spin chain correspondence essentially means that the dilatation operator is going to be mapped into an spin chain Hamiltonian. These operators, all single trace operators, are going to be mapped into a spin chain states. And the dimension, the scaling dimension of the operator, will be the eigenvalue for the corresponding spin chain Hamiltonian. This means the energy of the corresponding spin chain state. Now, if the spin chain Hamiltonian is integrable, we can use Bethe ansatz to diagonalize the Hamiltonian, and I will discuss a little bit, or essentially the content of the seminar, is to understand a little bit the meaning of integrability in this game. Now, the simplest example is single trace operators in what is called the SU2 sector. You can only consider two fields. And then this single trace operator you can visualize as a spin chain where you can interpret, for instance, the SIP as the spin up and the insertion of these impurities as a spin down. And essentially what you will try to see is, in order to compute the scaling dimension of this operator, to compute the energy of this two magnon or three magnon state in this spin chain. At one loop, this dilatation operator is a normal spin chain Hamiltonian, where you have interaction between near spins, but this will change immediately once you go to higher loops, and this is one of the important problems in all this question. Now, the first idea by Joseph Mirahan and Zarembo, that I believe was the beginning of all this story, was to understand for this particular sector SU2, this dilatation operator as the Heisenberg XXX spin chain. This is a well-known spin chain. It's very well-known for a long time. And we know that this spin chain is integrable, and we can compute the corresponding energies using the Bethe ansatz computation. Now, you consider, for instance, this particular case where you have two of these guys down, you can interpret this thing as two magnons that are moving in this spin chain with this particular momenta. And then the Bethe ansatz in principle, from a physics point of view, we will say a few words more about the Bethe ansatz, but for a physics point of view, it's telling you something very simple. It's simply telling you that the wave function of this magnon is going to be single-valued. Then when you move around, you will get a phase, which is simply the phase coming from the system of the momentum and the length of the chain. And you will get another phase factor coming from the scattering with the other magnons that are characterized by these S-matrix that appears here. Now, very good. Until now, everything is very good. Now, what is this S-matrix for the Heisenberg model? The S-matrix for the Heisenberg model, usually it's convenient to write it in terms of rapidities, rapidity variables, and is this object that I will explain a little bit where is the integrability contained in this S-matrix in a moment. Where UP, which is the relation between momentum and rapidity, is simply the cotangent of the momentum. Now, you want to understand where is the integrability here. There are many ways you can understand integrability. Usually, the most physical way is to think that the S-matrix that is characterizing the scattering of the magnons satisfies Jan-Buster equation. Now, this is something that you cannot immediately see from here because this is just numbers. You have not metrics, and then, okay, the Jan-Buster equation is not going to be very clear from this point of view. Then, in order to see the Heisenberg model as an integrable model, and this will be relevant for the connection with the Ising model that I am going to do in a moment, it's better to think in the Heisenberg model from the point of view of a Bertes model. This, let me just, in one half transparency, flash you a little bit what is this story if you are not very familiar with. Okay, suppose that you have a lattice model, and this lattice model is going to be a Bertes model in the sense that you assign Bertes variables or spin variables, if you want, arrows, to the links in your lattice. Now, to characterize this lattice, the only thing that you need is to give the Boltzmann weights for the corresponding possible configuration of arrows around one particular point. Six vertices means that you have only six different configurations of arrows, means conservation of this quantity. Now, you can think the spin chain state at this state here, where you have a spin up and down, and then you can consider that you move from this state in the spin chain to another state of the spin chain, and you do it by some sort of Hamiltonian. The way to introduce dynamics from the point of view of the lattice point of view is to introduce horizontal variables, that is this one that I am introducing here, that is the green variables, and the transition of the monodromy matrix, the transfer matrix, to go from this initial state to this final state will be just to sum over all possible configuration of the green variables and multiply the corresponding Boltzmann weights of this vertex. Now, these Boltzmann weights correspond to the EF, which is the initial and the final state of your spin chain, and the horizontal link arrows that you can put here. Now, these are the Boltzmann weights of the six vertex model. The integrability of the model means that if you define this Boltzmann weight depending on some particular variable U, and the next step you do for a different variable B, this TU, TB commute, and this is the origin of the system of an infinite number of conserved quantities. Now, so this TU is just simply the product of these Boltzmann weights for a particular parametrization. For instance, you can say that this Boltzmann wave for the six vertices can have some value, but I can change from arrow to arrow, from this value to a different value, and integrability means this conservation, this commutation. All these things are very well known, but the only thing I want to stress, just for the future, is that this integrability condition is what is the Jan-Buster equation. This integrability condition, now this Boltzmann wave that I was writing, you remember was a Boltzmann wave of this type, where here you can have up or down, here you can have up or down, and then you can consider this thing as going from a representation of SU2 of spin 1 half, for another representation of spin 1 half into V1 half, V1 half, which will be this in and out, if you want. And this is what is called the R matrix of the six vertex model, and integrability just means the famous Jan-Buster equation for this R matrix. Now, once you have this Boltzmann way, it's very easy to go to the Bethe-Ansatz using the algebraic Bethe-Ansatz, because essentially, you want just to remember you a little bit what is this story. When you have, and this is where you get a spin chain Heisenberg Bethe-Ansatz, you have this, and you sum over all possible horizontal possible values for the corresponding product of the Boltzmann ways, what you get is a matrix that will depend on the particular value you have here and the particular value you have here, Tij. This is a 2x2 matrix. You have A, B, C, D. Now, the algebraic Bethe-Ansatz consists in defining a reference state, which is the product of B's acting on the vacuum. Then when you act on T, this will give you the eigenvalue. You have unexpected terms. You put these unexpected terms equal to zero, and you get the Bethe-Ansatz equation. These are the Bethe-Ansatz of the XXX spin chain Hamiltonian in the particular limit in which you are considering a very, very simple R matrix, which is the limit where the deformation parameter goes to zero. Okay, this is just in order to say where is the underlying integrability of the Heisenberg model. That is something that is going to be important for us in a moment. Now, the question that appears immediately after this nice understanding of the dilatation operator in the SU2 sector in terms of the XXX spin chain is what happened at higher loops? Is integrability preserved at higher loops? How we can generalize to all this picture to the full superconformal algebra, to the all other sectors we have in our theory. And these are the questions that has been answered by many people along the last year or the last year and a half. Okay, essentially the first step going to the from one loop to all loop was the all loop Bethe-Ansatz conjecture by Beiser, Dippler, Staudacher, and I don't remember. Okay, and in reference I'm going to be just very sketchy because essentially you know the reference equally than me. Now, the generalization of the Heisenberg for the case of the SU2 sector that these people were suggesting was simply to do like that. We have the Bethe-Ansatz that I was writing for the XXX spin chain, and you simply write the same Bethe-Ansatz but change the relation between momentum and rapidity that was cotangent of P divided by 2, you change it to this quantity, where you introduce this square root, 1 plus AG squared sine squared P divided by 2, where G squared is the tough copy. Of course, for G equals 0, what you get is the standard Heisenberg model. This is consistent with the dispersion relation that you get once you have rapidity in terms of momentum, you get the energy in terms of momentum, and this is consistent with the BMN that yesterday David was presenting, for instance, energy momentum dispersion relation in BMN. But for the time being, at this point, it's just simply a wild guess to say that this thing is going to be related with any spin chain or that this thing have anything to do with integrability and so on and so forth. It's a very wild guess, and this, I believe, has been important to understand using an algebraic approach that I will present in a moment. Now, this was the first step. And the second step that sometimes is presented as something just simply notational was to introduce a very nice set of variables that are the x plus minus variables that everybody is using. These x plus minus variables are introduced by this condition. They define the momentum of the magnum by x plus divided by x minus. The rapidity u is defined by this expression in terms of x plus x minus. And these quantities must satisfy this relation. They can satisfy this relation, or you can generalize, as for instance Nick Dore was doing some time ago, you can generalize this relation putting here an n if you want to consider BPS states. But for the time being, let's just reduce to the standard relation for x plus minus variables. Now, these variables are crucial in order to extend the all loop Bethe-Ansatz to the other sectors, in particular to the SU11 sector when you have insertion of fermions, or to the SL2 sector that is very mysterious when you have insertion of covariant derivatives. Now, notice, there is here in this, let's say, 1 year and a half ago, the idea of in order to improve what Minahan and Zarembo were doing is, okay, let me just guess what is going to be the all loop Bethe-Ansatz that contains this very nice information, but we need to understand where is coming this object, of course, and to introduce this set of variables. Very good. Once you have this set of variables, then you have the all loop Bethe-Ansatz for the different sector, the SU2 sector, the SU11 sector, or the SL2 sector, where correspond to insertions of fermions or insertion of covariant derivatives. Here I have a comment, but I will postpone this comment to later, because if we start now thinking about BFKL Pomeroy, we can get completely confused. Then, if I have time, I will say a few words on this SL2 sector that is very interesting because it's related with an stuff in QCD that I believe is very nice. But okay, let's forget that for the time being, and I will come back to this. No, don't be worried, I come back just before lunch. Okay, then this was the situation in, let's say, I don't remember historically, but this was the situation until Beiser was trying to put in order all this thing using some algebraic structure, using some symmetry in order to get this all loop Bethe-Ansatz from an S-metric that satisfies the Jan-Buster equation, and that is coming from an underlying algebraic, an underlying symmetry. And this, I believe, is important to understand in order to see what I want to say. Let's say what was the idea of Beiser, essentially, what we can call the algebraic structure of this all loop Bethe-Ansatz. The idea was the following. First, we have the full superconformal symmetry, which is this algebra, but in principle we don't need all this full conformal superconformal symmetry. We need only the residual symmetry, which is relevant for the S-metrics, which is the one that is preserving the number of excitations. Now, this is the SU22 algebra, two copies of that with a central extension that is essentially the Hamiltonian. Now, what are the magnons? The magnons you interpret at irreps, 2-2 irreps of this algebra under each of these SU22. Now, what is the process, the procedure, in order to get the better answer? The procedure is the following. First idea is, OK, let's try to interpret the magnons as four-dimensional, in this particular case, irreps of this algebra. We can call it B-phi I. And let's try to define an X-matrix, which goes from the tensor product of these two irreps into the tensor product of the two irreps, U1 after a permutation, satisfying the Jahn-Buster equation. Of course, if you have this, then you can write immediately the all-loop Bethe ansatz, just putting the S-matrix that appears here on the left-hand side of the Bethe equations. Now, let's see how you can proceed in order to do that. Because I believe, it's just a question of, it's a probably technical question, but I believe there is a sort of misunderstanding of how the algebra is producing for you this S-matrix. Now, in order to do this thing algebraically, you can follow the standard path. I will do it very slowly now, which is the following. In order to, first thing that you need, once you say, okay, I have, let's see, where is the... Ah, yeah. You see here the ingredients that we have is, we have an algebra, in all cases SU22. Now, we have a concept of magnon that we say is an irrep, in this particular case a four-dimensional irrep. And of course, the first thing that we want to do is to define an S-matrix that goes from one irrep from the one magnon into the permuted one. Okay? Now, how you are going to fix this S-matrix in terms of the symmetry algebra? You will require that the S-matrix is invariant under the action of the algebra. Now, invariance under the action of the algebra requires one thing. You need to tell me how you apply, you extend the action of this algebra to a tensor product. Now, this is the first thing that you need to tell me. You need to tell me how this algebra is acting on this tensor product. Once you know how this algebra is acting on this tensor product, I can look for an S-matrix that is invariant under the action of this algebra. Now, the way this algebra is acting on this tensor product is what was defined by Beiser in a very very intuitive way. This is what he called dynamic spin chains. And it's very curious because algebraically contains a lot of information. It's what in mathematics we call a Hopf algebra. The reason is the following. Now, you have an element A of the algebra, and in order to extend the action of this element to the tensor product, which is going to be crucial if you want to characterize the S-matrix by invariance under the action of this algebra, you extend the action of this A to the tensor product. In order to do that, you need to define a comultiplication and to require that the S-matrix commutes with this comultiplication. Now, what happens normally? If you have a classical algebra, the comultiplication, which is nothing very spectacular, the comultiplication is what we say in physics composition rule, is the way you compose angular momenta or whatever when you are working on a tensor product of guys. Now, usually for classical algebra, the composition law is this, A cross 1 plus 1 cross A, which means you first act on the first particle, for instance, for angular momenta, and you send the result acting on the second particle. Now, this comultiplication is a comultiplication that satisfies a peculiar property, is that it's invariant under permutation. Delta 1, 2 is equal to delta 2, 1. Now, usually, when you introduce this thing here, satisfying this condition, what you get is still trivial S-matrix, es decir, just a permutation. Then what Beiser realized without saying it in his paper on the S-matrix is that you need in some way to deform this action of the algebra on the tensor product of irreps or the tensor product of magnons in such a way that you get a non-trivial relation from this equation.
You haven't mentioned Beiser's central extension.
I will do it in just one second. In just one second, in one, in this transparency. Either with, okay.
It's an alternative way of viewing that.
No, okay, I will tell you just in the next transparency. Now, but in order to go to the flow, the logical flow, okay, we have the algebra. We need to define some comultiplication. And let's see how this comultiplication was introduced by Beiser. Beiser did is what Nick was just commenting right now. But I want to put it in clear terms in order that the rest of the seminar will be understandable. What Beiser did is, First, he introduced two extra central elements. Very good. Nothing wrong with that. Then he defined a non-local co-multiplication for these central elements. This was introduced in a very peculiar way, without saying that was a co-multiplication, but he was doing that. He was defining a non-local co-multiplication for these central elements. This non-local co-multiplication is asymmetric, and is non-trivial. I will put the co-multiplication just in a moment. And by the way, this co-multiplication uses an extra generator that was not in the algebra before, which is the magnum momentum. Then he used three ingredients. The two first ingredients is adding two central elements. The next ingredient is introducing a non-local co-multiplication for these central elements. And the third element is, how is this co-multiplication non-trivial? This co-multiplication is non-trivial because you introduce here a deformation parameter, which is not one, will be one only when the momentum is zero, that we will discuss in a moment. Now, this co-multiplication is certainly asymmetric, as you can see immediately, because it's not the same thing for 1, 2, that for 2, 1. In the case for 2, 1, you will get this p in the point 1, and in the case 1, 2, this p is the p of the momentum of the second magnum. Then the important ingredients of the construction of Weiser, that in my opinion was a beautiful construction, is you say, okay, let me add two extra elements, let me introduce a co-multiplication that is what he called dynamic chain, and let me use in defining this co-multiplication an extra generator that is not in my algebra a priori, which is the magnum momentum. Okay, this is very funny because you are increasing the number of generators of your algebra if you require this thing to be an homomorphism of the algebra. This is a beautiful construction. Now, how this beautiful construction appears for Weiser? What Weiser did is the following. Let's say, okay, let me just define the two central elements B and R. Now, the two central elements B and R, he says, okay, the dynamic of the chain requires for me this co-multiplication. The way I'm acting with these central elements on the couple of two magnons is in this way, where this is the magnum momentum. Okay? Now, you can leave this co-multiplication to the rest of the algebra, requiring that delta to be an homomorphism, and what you define is essentially a Hopf algebra. But forget this mathematical terminology of Hopf algebra. What is interesting here is that this co-multiplication for the central elements can introduce the parametrization in terms of x plus minus that I was mentioning before in a very nice way. What happened is the following. These are central elements. Therefore, they commute with x. For these central elements, you don't get anything very important because delta of whatever of this central element, this delta b, because it's a central element, commute with x. Then this means that delta 1 to b must be delta 2 1 b. Now, this is very easy exercise. If you put delta 1 to b equal delta 2 1 b, you can get, if the eigenvalue of b is x, and this is, let's call c, exponential ip, what you get is this relation between x and the momentum. This famous relation between x and the momentum, or between y and the momentum, where x and y are the eigenvalues of b and r, is what we call the Weiser parametrization of the representation of the algebra. But notice one important thing. This information is not just a particular representation or parametrization that you can do. This contains the information about two important ingredients. One is this non-trivial co-multiplication with this deformation parameter. Second is adding an extra element, which is this momentum p. Now, once you have this thing, the Suhr lemma is telling you that all the representation can be characterized by the eigenvalues of the central elements. And this is where you get the parametrization that people use, that is Weiser parametrization. Now, by Suhr lemma, the reps are characterized by the central elements, x, y, and c. And the eigenvalues of the central elements are related with the momentum that you can call x plus plus x minus in this particular way. Now, this is the famous relation that, using the notation of Weiser, you will say here a, b is alpha x plus divided by x minus minus 1, c, d is beta x minus, and this alpha beta can be represented in terms of the Toff coupling. Now, once you have this representation, the closure of the algebra is what produced this famous relation. But notice, this has nothing to do with the algebra. This information is not contained in the algebra. This information is contained in the coalgebra with an extra generator, which is the magnum momentum, and with non-trivial co-multiplication. Without that ingredients, you cannot get this representation, just if you get some inspiration, but you don't get this representation because all these quantities are referring to something that is not in the algebra, that is the magnum momentum. Now, I put an student, that is the way Johan started this thing, I put an student how this thing is related with Jan Buster. Now, let me just summarize here. You have two ingredients. One is the algebra. Very nice. You have the reps. You can centrally extend this algebra. No problem. The second thing is that you need to define the action of the algebra of a tensor product. You introduce a co-multiplication. And this co-multiplication for Bicep, for this dynamic spin change, is two things. It's asymmetric or non-local. And the second thing, contains in the deformation parameter, which makes this co-multiplication asymmetric, a new generator, which is the magnetic momentum. This is the way you introduce the x plus x minus variables when you parameterize this thing by that. Now, what is the meaning of that equation in this setup? The meaning of that equation is precisely equivalent to the Jan Buster equation for the S-matrix that Bicep was computing. You can do this exercise. It's a painful exercise, but it's a nice exercise to do it. If you just consider the S-matrix, for instance, in the first paper by Bicep, Dippler, Staudacher, or Bicep, Staudacher, I don't know, some of these combinations, for the SU1-2, the S-matrix satisfies Jan Buster, but it's automatic. It's completely trivial, this Jan Buster. In order to, it's completely independent of this relation. This relation appears, and the origin is because you need the two central extensions, this relation appears as equivalent. One thing is implication in one direction, another is implication in the other direction, and I'm talking to you about implication in the other direction, as equivalent to the Jan Buster equation for the SU22 S-matrix. I don't know if I, let me just put here a transparency, and we can, then, the, what I was to try to tell you in this, with these introductory remarks, is important. It's important to notice that the integrability of all this spin chain, of the SU22 spin chain associated with n equal 4 superjohn mills, is contained not in the algebra. It's contained in the coalgebra. This is something that is very natural and very well understood in integral models. Now, where is the structure of this coalgebra? The symmetry algebra is this, with this central extension, and the information contained in the coalgebra is essentially this famous x plus x minus variables, this beautiful relation, and the co-multiplication. When you combine the two things, that you can combine it in a way that you don't see this coalgebra structure very easily, that is the way Bicep did it in a very smart way, that is you define a co-multiplication for the central elements and you introduce this x plus s minus as parametrization of some representations here once you have used this non-trivial co-multiplication, as I presented in the previous transparency. Okay, once you combine these two ingredients, you get the full S-matrix and the all-loop S-matrix Betti-Ansatz. Now, this is the beginning of the discussion. What I want to do now is to try, in a small comment if you want, to try to explain what is the meaning of these quantities, x plus and x minus, and this equation. This equation that I am telling you is equivalent to the Jan Buster equation for this S-matrix. Okay. You want any question at this point? Yes, somebody complains? Because usually,
Jan Buster is only obeyed on shell, if you like, for the.
Jan Buster is only obeyed when you import this condition.
Right, which is that is the relationship between the energy and the momentum.
For the SU22, for the SU12 case, for the 4x4 S matrix, Jan Buster is automatic independently of the values of x plus and x minus. Then this is a peculiarity of the SU22 S matrix. It's okay. Now, let me now suggest this spin chain is in correspondence to see if I can convince you about. Okay, this is a very simple, suppose that, let me just remember from the book of Buster or the book, the example of von Sager, the Ising model in the square lattice. The Ising model in the square lattice, you just simply have the square lattice, where couplings K and L, and you put the spin variable sigma I in these points that can be plus or minus one. Usually in the Ising model, in the Ising spin chain, you have two couplings, J and J prime, which is the horizontal and the vertical spin-spin interactions. When you introduce the temperature and the Boltzmann constant, you can define K and L. And the Ising model partition function is simply that. Sum over all possible configurations, where I and J are horizontal, you have this Boltzmann way. When K and L are vertical, you have this Boltzmann way. This is a two-dimensional Ising partition function. Okay, let me just map the magnum variables, x plus minus. which is this Magnum variable, into these easing couplings by this simple relation. And I say x plus minus, that you can imagine that are the Magnum variables I was writing before or not. Just call it x plus minus. Simply exponential 2k, exponential minus 2l.
You're going to have to analytically continue the parameters of the Ising model to the complex values to make that relation.
Right. I analytically continue. Because this is going to be IP. This is going to be real. But this, OK, you will see this thing in a moment. Before, just simply let's do that. Let's do an exercise at this point. Let's simply say k and l can be any complex arbitrary numbers in just the solution of Onsager or in Buster. And just put, let me just put x plus minus like that. Now, let me just compute the transfer matrix of this model. Now, the transfer matrix contains two pieces. One is when you go from one line to another line by this, that is, I am using the notation of Baxter, that is B matrix. And then you go to the next step by the other one, U1. If I put it here, then this will be the B, and this will be the W that I am writing here. This is the B and the W. Now, the B goes from a state of spins, sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3, to a set of spins, sigma prime 1, sigma prime 2, sigma prime 3, and so on. And then the way you do it is just simply multiply the corresponding Boltzmann weights. Now you have another matrix for going from this sigma 1 to sigma prime, which will be the next one. The transfer matrix is the product of B and W, and the partition function is simply the trace of this transfer matrix. Now you can enjoy yourself. It's an exercise that is taking 5 minutes in writing using the previous map in these variables, the transfer matrices. I am going to do it just for a chain of two spins. You can do it for arbitrary number of spins, but let's put it in a chain of two spins with periodic boundary condition, that the reason this is the same thing that this one. Okay, in other words, suppose sigma 1, sigma 2 for two points will be sigma 1, sigma 2. This will be sigma 1, sigma prime 1, sigma prime 2. Now you compute the B matrix, which can go plus, 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 minus, and so on and so forth in these bases. And the B matrix can be defined in terms of these x plus minus variables in very simple terms. And the same thing for the W. Okay. This is a trivial exercise, high school, not even high school exercise. You just simply do this. For instance, this example, when you go to from plus plus to plus plus, just to give you a flavor of what is going on here, then you will have the periodic boundary condition, then you put this in plus. Then here, these are k's and these are l's. Then you will have exponential k, exponential 2k, exponential l, exponential 2l. Using the previous parameterization will be 1 over x minus. For instance, this will be the plus plus into minus minus. Then you will have exponential minus k, exponential minus k, exponential minus l, exponential minus l, which will be exponential minus 2k minus 2l, which is the inverse, which is x minus. Now you have the b and the w. With this, you can compute the transfer matrix in terms of these variables. But the important thing is to do exactly what Onsager was doing and to do the integrability of this model. Now, what is the definition of integrability? The Jahn-Buster equation for the first place where the Jahn-Buster, before Jahn and Buster equation appears, which is an Onsager beautiful solution of the two-dimensional Ising model. Now, you can consider now that you have how you define this thing. Remember from the beginning of the seminar, I was telling you that Jahn-Buster equation is, when you have the transfer matrix, what you are looking for in order to have an infinite number of conserved charges is conservation of this type. Now, from the point of view of the Ising model, I have the Ising model. I have a set of spins. Let's see. Do it. Now I go from this to this, and from this to this. Now the way Onsager was doing the integrability is, let's say, suppose that I put a spins interaction here, k1, l1, k1, l1, k1, l1. In other words, I am measuring the spin interaction here by coefficient k1, l1, k, and that's it. Now, suppose that this gives you a transfer matrix for going from this state into this state that will be depending on the particular values k1 and l1. Let's call it this, the transfer matrix 1. Now, you go from this line into this line, but you say, I change. I put here k2, l2, arbitrary for the time being, k2, l2. And then you have 2. Now, what Onsager did is, OK, let me just require that this thing commute. Arbitrary k1 is arbitrary, k2, l2. Now, this commutation relation is equivalent, and this is to what we call the Jan-Buster equation, as we can just see in a moment in the transparency. Now, this is the integrability of the model, and this is telling you that you have an infinite number of conserved charges, because you can put this thing in continuous variables. Now, when you parameterize the curve on which this equation is solved, is the elliptic curve usually associated with the Ising model, or the elliptic curve that we have associated with the n equal 4 SU2 spin chain. Now, let's do it. Suppose now that we use language of magnets. Suppose that you have two magnets, S1 plus minus and X2 plus minus. I use the first magnon to define the transfer matrix here, the second magnon to define the transfer matrix here. Now, what is the integrability of the Ising model? The integrability of the Ising model is telling me that BS1 W X2 is equal to BS2 W S1. This is the equation that was solved by Onsager. Now, this equation is easy to see because you see this is B1 W2 and this is B2 W1. In order to have this equation, the transfer matrix, to be independent, then this is the existence of another matrix M that satisfies this equation. This I am doing in different notation, and this is equivalent to the Jan-Buster equation. If you are really interested, I can do it on the blackboard, but okay, simply this is very standard. The way you get from the, in the Ising model from the Onsager solution, the Jan-Buster equation representation of this commutation relation. Okay, this is the integrability of the Ising model. Let's do it now for two magnons. Okay, this is what surprised me. And I was, when you do it, is an exercise that you can do it in less than 1 hour. You do this computation for the Jan-Buster equation, and what you get? You get that this thing must be constant. Exactly the relation between the x plus and x minus that we were considering and that we know is equivalent to the Jan-Buster equation for the SU22 spin chain. Okay, that's very nice, because now we can start getting some kind of dictionary to this underlying Ising model stuff, which is simply, if you want, a different way to understand, not the part of the SU22 algebra. What I am trying to understand here is not this symmetry that we understand very well from the point of view of ADS5. What I want to understand is what is the content of this stuff, or in other words, what is the content of these variables, the physical content of these variables. Now what I am getting is this relation. In other words, I am getting that this, which is the condition for the Jan-Buster equation for the SU22 S matrix, is exactly equivalent to the Jan-Buster equation for the Ising model under the corresponding map. Now you get now a sort of dictionary that is very curious. This constant that appears here in the Ising model have a very nice meaning. It's the elliptic modulus of the Onsager solution. And this elliptic modulus now is, if you put here I divided by G, is related with the tough coupling constant and is an analytic extension of this quantity of the elliptic modulus. There is nothing problematic in an elliptic for elliptic curves to use the elliptic modulus and to extend it to imaginary, to the whole plane. You have problems of analyticity at the origin that I'm going to discuss related with Cramer's Vanier duality transformation or modular transformations. Now, this is a...
In the case of the Ising model, are you saying that this equation defines the elliptic curve?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is the equation defining the elliptic curve. Uh-huh. I can prove to you if you want in the blackboard in a moment. Is the elliptic curve of the Ising model in particular, of the this equation, x plus plus 1 over x plus minus s minus minus 1 over x minus equal constant. When you have x plus minus equal, if you use this notation, you can see that this equation is simply 4 sine hyperbolic 2k sine hyperbolic 2l equal constant. And the elliptic curve of Onsager is simply sine hyperbolic 2k sine hyperbolic 2l equal the elliptic modulus. Of course, the elliptic modulus that you will get for a physical Ising model where this thing is real will be a wave, will be out of your physical region for the coupling constant. But if you just simply extend from the point of view of elliptic function, there is no problem to extend this thing, to work this thing in the all the elliptic, all the complex plane. The relation between the elliptic modulus and the tough coupling is through this I. Okay, very nice. This is the first. You see, the reason, let me just tell you before continuing and advertising a little bit what I'm going to
can
tell.
Can I just ask a quick thing? So
for sure.
Maybe you're going to say this, but so k equals 1 is singular, so
K equal 1 is singular, but K equal 1, no, K equal 1 is not singular, it's just the phase transition point. We are going to discuss K equal 1.
There's also singularity also in Yang-Mills, but I can't remember how you define your G, but it's...
The G is just the top coupling, G squared N. I don't know if...
No, with your factors of 8 pi, but they have there's a singularity at G squared equals minus a fourth, but I think that's...
I'm going to discuss in the next transparency, in few transparencies. Exactly what you was essentially thinking is what forced me to think in terms of this is the model. You see, the Cramer's Vanier duality, that you is what you are in a certain sense thinking, is the duality, is the first duality that we know in physics, probably. After that came, probably Dirac duality, electric magnetic duality was before Cramer's Vanier. After that was Cramer's Vanier. Then we have Montonen-Olive duality. And now these days we have Maldacena duality. What is peculiar in Maldacena's duality is that it's a duality not for the coupling constant, it's a duality for the tough coupling constant. Okay? This is what is peculiar of Maldacena's. Montonen-Olive is a transformation of a coupling constant, 1G to 1 over G, but not for the tough coupling constant, it's for the standard coupling constant. For tough coupling constant, things look fantastic. You go from a theory to a string theory. This is what ADS conformal field theory is teaching us. Now here you have that, okay, doing this kind of manipulations, which I believe are just straight and not cheating, you get a relation, of course, not with the nice thing because you have this I, between the tough coupling constant and the elliptic modulus of the Ising model. The reason I was trying to think in this direction is because, okay, Cramer's Vanier duality is the most natural duality, it's the duality of the Ising model that goes from K into 1 over K, because this is the definition of Cramer's Vanier duality for the Ising model. Then, in a certain sense, can be related with some kind of a strong weak coupling transformation for the tough coupling constant. Can I learn something from that?
It's the modular symmetry of the elliptic curve, is that what it is? Or
sorry?
It's just the modular transformation of the electric of the elliptic
no,
curve.
No.
It's not that.
No. The Cramer's Vanier duality is not that.
Elliptic modulus k goes to 1 over k, I thought was some, for an elliptic curve, that's usually some element of the duality group.
Okay, let me just go to the next transparency and I will tell you in a moment, because I have a discussion on this particular thing. What you are saying is that k, if k is the electric modulus, you are thinking that tau goes to minus 1 over tau.
No, not minus 1 over tau, but some other element of the S duality group.
But not this one.
Not that
no,
one.
No, no, no.
It's a combination of that and the other one.
Okay, in 1 second I will discuss this thing. Okay, then this was my motivation. Okay, now we go also to the point one and so on. Now, in order to understand a little bit more the physics, okay, what is the relevant thing that you use in order to understand physics in the Ising model, the correlation length? The correlation length is what is telling you where you have critical phenomena, when the correlation length goes to infinity, and so on and so forth. Then what is the correlation length in this in this notation, in this x plus x minus? Can we get see some light on the... Okay, the correlation length can be written in this way for the Ising model, where k is the elliptic modulus. This u is just, you remember one thing that's very familiar, is just the rapidity variable that you use. This is the rapidity variable that you use in the whole loop Bethe ansatz. And this correlation length, as you can see immediately, is invariant under Cramer's Vanier duality transformation, k going to 1 over k, u going to k, u. The self-dual point for the Ising model is k equal 1, which is the one that you was mentioning. And it's, of course, the point you see immediately where this correlation length becomes infinity, because you get a logarithm of 1, then this is infinity. Then is the typical critical point, which is the self-dual point. This is the way Cramer's Vanier discovered the system of a critical point in Ising model. Of course, k equal 1 is out of the physical region from the point of view of the tough coupling constant, because the tough coupling k is 4ig, and then this is never 1 by any real positive g. Then, of course, we don't expect to have this critical point in the Yang-Mills theory coming from the picture that we get from this Ising model, from the critical point of the Ising model. However, there is something that we can try to see, is what is the meaning of this correlation length from the point of view of the magnum physics? The correlation length from the point of view of the magnum physics is essentially the inverse of the magnum momentum. It's like the Broglie length for the magnum momentum when you are working in magnum momentum very, very small. Now, you can see this thing very easily. In the limit of magnum momentum going to zero, that notice why I'm interested in this limit. This limit I'm interested because the deformation of the algebra, remember, the algebra is not A cross 1, the coalgebra, plus 1 cross A. And the reason it's not like that is because here you have exponential IP. Or in the string side, exponential IP string, if you want, where it's dp divided by square root of lambda. Now, what is deforming the algebra? Is this guy. What perturbation theory you have naturally defined from this point of algebra? The expansion of this exponential. Now, what happened at p equals 0? At p equals 0, you go essentially to the classical algebra. Then I'm interested in this region p equals 0, what is from the easy model point of view, what happens. And what happened in this limit is the following. Is in this regime where the p goes to 0, essentially the correlation length goes, the inverse of the correlation length goes like the momentum. You can see here that you get I momentum plus here I give you minus with you plus g multiplied by p. This g multiplied by p is essentially what you call in this game string momentum. This will be the magnum momentum and this will be the string momentum. Now this momentum is the inverse of the correlation length when you are working in a regime which is near to zero. Now you can be surprised here. You say, oh, where p is equal to zero, that is the point where this thing becomes almost classical, the correlation length goes to infinity. You have some kind of critical point. Of course, this is not the critical point of the two-dimensional Issel model. This is the critical point of the one-dimensional Issel model, because in the moment you go to p equals zero, what you are just is reducing the Issel model, the two-dimensional Issel model, to a one-dimensional Issel model, because essentially what you are doing, if this is the interaction, let's say L, and this is the interaction K, you are leading this interaction to zero, and then effectively you are working with a one-dimensional Issel model. This one-dimensional Issel model, there is no phase transition in one-dimensional Issel model, you know, but contains a critical point, and this is the critical point that we are just describing here. Now, in order to summarize a little bit this discussion before entering into something a little bit more speculative, let me tell you what we did. What we did essentially is to map this kinematic relation that you can put here n. I will discuss a little bit the n of Nick in a moment. This kinematic relation that we know is the integrability condition for the SU22 S matrix into the Jan-Buster equation for the Issel model. The TOF coupling into the elliptic modulus. The magnum momentum, where the momentum is small, into the inverse of the correlation length. And the rapidity variable into the Issel model partition function. You can write the partition function directly in terms of the rapidity variable. Now, as I mentioned before, one of the reasons I was trying to understand this stuff is two. One is because I was curious to understand the meaning of these equations and these variables. And second thing is because I am curious to understand, to see if the Cramer-Swanier duality transformation can give you some information, some nice information. Now, with respect to this, which is the most speculative thing, I cannot tell you too much. The only thing I can tell you, and now we can discuss your question on this modular transformation, is this thing. Okay. Suppose that this is the elliptic modulus plane. The physical region in which we are for g positive is this line. This is the self-dual point where we have the phase transition. Now, this is the origin where we can have some singularities for the elliptic functions, for the elliptic periods, kk and k prime k. We can have some singularity at this origin, and we have, in fact, some monodromy that produces the modular group around the zero. Now, what Cramer-Swanier is doing is something that is not nice for us because it's going from this physical region away from the physical region. But in any case, we can define this Cramer-Swanier transformation as composed from two transformations. One is just we go from 4ig to minus 4ig by some transformation I'm going to call t. And then I go from this into this by a transformation S that I am not changing I, but I am changing G into 1 over 16G. That is the 16 probably that you was referring to. This is a typical strong weak coupling transformation that I am doing. And this is changing the sign. If you are working in the approach of Nick where you have the N, this is like going from N positive to N negative. That is something that you claim in your paper with Juan Maldacena. That is something that is required by crossing, right? But okay, this we can discuss later. Now, look, this transformation is a very nice modular transformation. K going to minus K is just a transformation for the tau, which is the complex structure of the elliptic curve, tau going to tau plus 2. Now, in a certain sense, what we know here, and I cannot say more about that, is that the Kramers-Banier Ising transformation is just simply a modular transformation in the SL2 set group of the elliptic curve, which is just precisely tau going to tau plus 2, plus, okay, this I put in quotations, plus the transformation going from tough coupling to 1 over tough coupling. Now, this for me is appealing, because this is a kind of symmetry that we understand very well. This is a simple modular transformation, and this is something that contains essentially the meat of all this game, which is a weak, a strong dual transformation for tough coupling. Of course, I am not going to say too much more about this. And I will just mention some exercise that I put to my student. Okay. Now, if you go to the self-dual point from the point of view of G going to 1 over 16G, that is the 1 over 4 that you was probably remembering. Okay, depends on 4 gi, 4 pi squared.
No, I was worried. No, the one is, there's the singularity is that g equals I over 4.
Uh-huh. No, but if you go to the self-dual point, yeah. Okay, then the Kramers-Banier duality becomes simply the modular transformation. And of course, this modular transformation is a symmetry of the SU2 to S matrix. But there is no phase transition, or there is not anything peculiar for the correlation length at g equal 1, 4. At this particular point, there is nothing spectacular, which is, in principle, reasonable. Now, the question, of course, is if this Kramers-Banier duality underlying the Ising model that contains the integrability of the SU2 spin chain is telling us something about the strong weak tough coupling duality. This, I have no idea. Let me just comment something that I put an exercise to Johan, and I say, okay, suppose that somebody is very smart, this is just a marginal comment, suppose that somebody is very smart and knows Kramers-Banier duality. And suppose that you start and I give you the XXX spin chain. Okay? Now I tell you, generalize this equation by requiring Kramers-Banier duality. Kramers-Banier duality is immediately a transformation on this P because this P is related with K, and then this is the standard Kramers-Banier duality transformation. And I say, Johan, okay, look for the most general quantity that starting with that, okay, satisfying this condition at G equals 0, satisfy Kramers-Banier duality. And up to functions that are independent of P, this is the only solution satisfying this Kramers-Banier duality transformation, which is okay. It's a sort of if you want, just marginal.
Tracks on both the coupling constant and the momentum.
Right. Right. Just you do the usual Kramers-Banier. P is related since we have x plus minus equal exponential plus minus 2k exponential minus 2l. Then exponential IP is x plus divided by x minus, which is exponential of 4k. Now you have the relation between k and p. And then the Kramers-Banier duality transformation go from k to k star. Then you do this transformation, and if you want from g, from k to 1 over k, that here will be the transformation for the g's. And then you ask, okay, suppose that I know only what Minahan and Zaremba did, and I want to get the whole loop Bethe-Ansatz equation. Can I get it just imposing this? And you will say, oh, from where is coming this Kramers-Banier duality transformation? But I put it just like simple exercise. Okay, then I believe here I can just finish the seminar. I don't know if you are interested, I can make some comments, but after finishing the seminar with respect to this BFKL stuff, that, okay, is another stuff. Okay, let me just conclude. Conclude with something that is a statement and something that is a question, but already I mentioned these two things. The statement is that the integrability of this SU2 Young-Mills planar spin chain is equivalent to the Young-Master equation for the two-dimensional Ising model. And the question is, in what way, if any, this Kramers-Banier duality of the Ising model that can be related with the strong weak coupling through a modular transformation in the SL2 set of the elliptic curve is telling us something about this ADS conformal field theory correspondence. Okay, I believe I stop here, and if you are interested, we can discuss later on this BFK. Thank you very much.
Okay, I don't know what everybody else feels. I would quite like to hear the BFKL formula?
I cannot say too much about this BFKL, but the reason I like this thing is because the other thing I am working is in a completely crazy idea about relating Pomeron, hard Pomerons, and black holes. Okay, that's the reason I am interested in this BFKL Pomeron. But I have something here that surprised me this summer, and is the following. In the SL2 sector, okay, all this story can be very much related to the hard Pomeron. This is the only comment that I have for this seminar. Okay, and what is here? What happens? Okay, what is the hard Pomeron or the BFKL Pomeron? The BFKL Pomeron, okay, you are interested in some scattering. You are interested in scattering in the Rayleigh regime, where S is going to be very large, but T is going to be very small. You are in the very diffractive regime. Then, in principle, what BFKL were doing is defining the interchange of something that has the quantum numbers of the vacuum, must be a singlet, that is composed of two Rayleigh gluons. And the Bethe-Salpeter equation for the interaction between these two Rayleigh gluons is what people call the BFKL Pomeron. Now, this box here depends on the transversal momentum. The way you do this thing is a sort of randomization group approach. You integrate all the longitudinal momentum, you put a cutoff, which is in principle S, and you get some things that depends on log S. This is the typical Rayleigh kinematics or the typical Rayleigh regime, and in that way you get something that looks like a string object. That is like the hard Pomeron. Now, the hard Pomeron is given by this quantity, where you have the spin J, you have this famous D gamma function, and that's it. Now, what you get from here is, you can immediately see if you integrate over J, you get from here a behavior of this type, and this is the typical BFKL Pomeron, where this quantity is the D gamma function. Now, what is this from the point of view of the SL2 sector? Oh, from the point of view of the SL2 sector, is a very peculiar object, which is this quantity, where this, which will be the number of magnons, in the language that we use, is minus 1 plus omega. Now, what people was Staudacher, Kotikov, Lipatov, and some collaborators that I cannot remember, and I remember Lipatov this summer or this spring was explaining to me this thing, they did is something very curious. Is, let's say, if we have this all loop Bethe ansatz equation, and we don't know exactly how good it is in terms of wrapping effects and so on and so forth, let's do an exercise. Let's compute the corresponding eigenvalues for positive m here. Okay. Let's analytically continue to minus 1. And let's compare with what Mr. Lipatov is telling us is the anomalous dimension for this guy. This is a way to check what we are doing. It's a different check of CASP anomalous dimension, if you want. It's a check of what we are doing in the computation of all loop Bethe ansatz. I don't know if I am making myself clear.
Why is it related to the dimension, the anomalous dimension of an operator?
Okay, let's go by steps. Usually what you will do in SL2 spin chain will be trace set dm set, and this will be the number of magnons. Okay, now your Bethe ansatz will be E pi L, L equal 2 in this particular case, equal product of m. You will put the S matrix for the SL2 sector, you will be happy, and then you will get an energy, which is the anomalous dimension. Very good. Now, what I believe Lipatov was asking these people is the following. Okay, you get an energy that depends on m, of course, and on the coupling constant g. Very good. Now, what is the Pomeron, the hard Pomeron? The hard Pomeron is this.
Why is it?
This is what I tried to explain a little bit. Okay, what is the okay? This will require the word selection, but okay. What is the hard Pomeron? The hard Pomeron is the interchange of a singlet, okay, a very high energy and a small transfer momentum in the diffractive regime. Now these objects are Rayleigh gluons. Now what people call the BFKL Pomeron is this kernel, this black box. From which object? On what depends this black box? Depends on the momentum of the guys that are entering. Since I have transfer momentum zero, these are the same, and an S. This box depends on the momentum and on S. Okay? Now, this is a Melin transform of the Bethe-Salpeter equation that you are solving in order to get this guy. If you are interested, I can do it, but okay, this will require more time. And this has this piece, this aspect. This aspect, if you remember in string theory, is not very unnatural. This is the typical Rayleigh behavior. Okay? You want is a sort of Fourier transform of the Rayleigh behavior. But the Rayleigh behavior now is given by this famous D-gamma function of Mr. Of the BFKL pomeron. This is the characteristic of the BFKL pomeron. Now, the question is, what is this new? This new, if you want, is the way these eigenfunctions are depending on the transversal momentum. Okay? This is what is going to play the role of the scaling dimension. In other words, this thing is going to depend on k. In the scaling dimension, you will say it's something that depends on x or whatever to 2 delta. Here, these things, the eigenfunction that are entering into this, depends on k, which is the Fourier transform, as k to the power nu. Now, this nu is what is playing the anomalous dimension. Now, what is the particular object in this language corresponding to the BFKL pomeron? Then you need to know what is the value that is appearing here. Now, the m that appears here, the m in the language of magnons, is what we will call, let's say, is j plus 2. And j here is 1 plus alpha, the strong coupling of this x nu. Sorry, 1 plus omega, let's say. Sorry, no. I did it wrongly. Okay. Now, you have this behavior, this 1 plus alpha. J is this 1 plus alpha. Now, the m that you are writing here is, what is this? J is 1, no. Sorry, because j is probably m plus 2 or something like that. I don't remember this thing. But in other words, you get the value of this, okay, the value that you put here is coming from the j that appears in the Rayleigh behavior of this guy. And then this corresponds, and now this, forgetting the change of notation, to minus 1 plus omega. Now, what is what Lipatov was asking to the spin chain people? Spin chain people is saying, okay, let me just put omega very small. Then do your exercise for arbitrary m. Analytically continue to n equal minus 1. And in the neighborhood of n equal minus 1, tell me what is the anomalous dimension. I can do this thing for free, because the anomalous dimension is just invert this equation for the d gamma. When I invert this equation, I am telling you analytically in omega what is the anomalous dimension around the point minus 1. If coincides with what you are telling me, OK. If not, bad luck for the spin chain. And it's not in agreement. OK? This is something that is very curious because, okay. Now, one thing that will be very interesting is from the point of view of the Kasp anomalous dimensions or the geometry of the Wilson loops, now I am entering into something that completely marginal, is to understand the origin of this quantity, of this d-gamma. Okay, if you want, I have some ideas about that, but we can discuss in private. Probably this, but this is something that I believe we should understand in this game. Is the connection with BFKL physics is something that we should understand.
What is it that's playing the role of the dilatation operator? I mean, because in the operator's language, everything is to do with eigenvalues of the dilatation operator. So here it's some operator that generates generates propagation in the T channel or something like
right,
that.
Right.
It's not dilatations. I mean the things that are not analogous to anomalous dimensions in this BFKL setup aren't literally anomalous dimensions of operators, right?
It's exactly the same thing. The point here, from the point of view of physics, is the following. BFKL or DGLAP, I don't know if you are really, DGLAP is the other. In this QCD physics, what you have is the following. These quantities that what are telling you is essentially hold the you have what are telling you is the following thing is the behavior of the gluon distribution functions, and this is a normalization group approach, the gluon distribution function in terms. Suppose that you have an hadron, okay? And then you look into the partons inside the hadron. Then there are two characteristics for this parton. It's the size of this parton, how many partons you find of a certain size, and the amount of rapidity of your hadron carried by these small partons. Now, the distribution function that are interested for QCD people is function that depends, is the number of partons in an hadron that for certain transversal momentum and carrying some small rapidity of this. Now, there are two renormalization group equations, if you want two dilatation operators, that you can think here, BFKL or DGLAP. which is how this function, distribution function, change when I change the size of the parton, or when I change a boost. I boost and I change the rapidity.
So one of those things is
the variation under the rapidity is BFKL.
Right.
The variation under K plus is DGLAP.
Right.
Okay, then the anomalous dimension, you get it from both sides. Usually the anomalous dimension you get from DGLAP, and this is the way you define the anomalous dimension, which is the variation from K plus, which is just simply dilatation of the normal dilatation. You just change the size of the space. Now you have the dual version, which is BFKL, which is the variation with respect to X. In the particular case of N equal 4, Kotikoff and Lipatov prove that you can relate. You will have Lipatov in a few weeks here, okay, you can ask himself. was considering the relation between DGLAP and BFKL in N equal 4. Now, as I say, you have a distribution function. Here is the function, let's say K plus, here is X, and then the evolution in this direction is BFS is DGLAP. The evolution in this direction is BFKL. Okay? And both defined in U1 an anomalous dimension. Okay, but this is a different story. Okay, if you want, we can discuss about that. But okay, that's
okay. Any more questions going back to the main seminar? So
sure.
So can you say something about, say, relating order and disorder parameters in the Ising model to a particular?
Sorry.
Like the Ising model comes with disorder parameter, order parameters, and
right?
How do they relate to?
No, something that I'm thinking. The only thing I check is the correlation length. The only thing I identify is the correlation length. And the correlation length, when you are in a small momentum, is like the Broglie length of the Magnum momentum. But I don't know what is. I don't know if the analogy can be continuous, and everything is going to have meaning. Okay, for the time being, this is not even published. Okay, is this what I have? Okay, this is a small comment. But it looks surprising to me that this integrability structure is exactly the Ising model equation. Okay.
But can you find some analog? So that's the dispersion relation, if you like, of the magnon is kind of mapped to the Ising model.
No.
Matrices called X plus is an X minus.
There are two things. One thing is this equation. Or in your case, this is N, which you will put here. Okay, let's put it like that. Another thing is the dispersion relation. Okay, the dispersion relation is energy equal G divided by I, and I don't remember, it's X plus, I don't remember, minus 1 over X, I don't remember, it's a relation between these guys.
Right, so somehow the way I think of it is, given the relationship between E and P and the X pluses and X minuses, then that constraint equation somehow is the...
You see, but one thing that people, I believe, is a little bit confusing is the following thing. Suppose that I get the algebra. The algebra, you know that E is the central extension C. The algebra is telling you how to relate the central extension C to the other central extensions. In particular, it's telling you that this will be something like 1 plus xy, where x is the eigenvalue of one of the central extensions, y the eigenvalue of the other central extension.
Only on a short representation, though.
Sorry?
That relation only holds on a short representation.
In a short representation, right. But you will get this thing. This is the eigenvalue of one of the central elements, this is the eigenvalue of the other central element, this is the eigenvalue of C. Now, in order to get to promote this thing to a dispersion relation, you must tell me how X and Y are related with momenta. Okay? Because the contrary, Y must be related with momenta. This is where the co-multiplication, the co-algebra enters. Because who is telling you how X and Y is related with momenta, which is the famous relation, some constant x plus divided by x minus minus 1, or something like that.
Well, Beiser did it by looking at how... Beiser
did it by hand. Just thinking in dynamics and just physical arguments.
This is the algebraic.
This is where the... Yeah. But here you see enters something very curious. Enters a co-multiplication, that is hidden here, and a new guy, which is the momentum. The momentum is not at this point here. In other words, what the algebra is telling you is just this relation. But this relation is EP only when you introduce the ingredient of how to put X and Y in terms of P, which is this type of relation, right? And this is the only thing in order to get this. You don't need this equation in order to get the dispersion relation. Now, this equation is, for instance, I can give you an example. S12, which is a 4 cross 4 S matrix, satisfies Jan Buster equation. satisfy this dispersion relation, and you don't need for anything this equation. You don't need it, because the Jan-Buster equation is satisfied independently of that. You need this equation in order to uniformize, because what this equation is providing you is the variable u and the possibility to write this thing in terms of an algebraic curve and to define the crossing transformation but variation of semiperiods. For that, you need this equation. But the dispersion relation is simply the relation between C and the other two guys, as you know very well, the other two guys in the central terms. Now, Weiser was so smart that he introduced the momentum of the magnon from the sky by, you remember, by these funny arguments. You say, and apparently this looks like if the algebra contains everything, because then you say, oh, but the algebra contains this closure relation AD minus BC equal 1, and from that I get this, and so on and so forth. I say, come on, how the algebra can know so many things? No, the algebra knows this thing because you introduce into the algebra an extra piece, which is the momentum, and an extra piece, which is this co-multiplication. Okay? Is these extra pieces the ones that I map into the Easing model? I don't touch, the Easing model is not touching for me the SU22O. This goes, this is the symmetry that the anti-de Sitter is telling us that we have.
Okay. There are no more questions. Let's thank Cesar again.